Previously
on Beta.
All right, so the system pulling away right now, and the sunshine increasing, and there is a dog behind me.
And they had no hole in the center of the record, so a lot
no,
of
you'd
the,
have to provide
the,
it
the people complain that you'd get this vinyl, of course, in those days, and it's kind of up to you to kind of center it.
They're not legally mandated to play this.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, writer Wendy Mitchell joins us to talk about her book, Citizen Canine, Dogs in the Movies.
Really, if you see a dog ill or slipping away on screen, you think of somebody you've lost or a dog you've lost, and it can be really emotional.
And Eric Johnson of the folk supergroup Bonnie Light Horseman on reimagining traditional folk songs from centuries ago.
This is like, sounds made up, but completely true. He just opened to that page and said, sing those lyrics over that melody. And it fit completely perfectly.
But first,
on the way home, I listened to Sylvia's new podcast. This episode is called The Center Cannot Hold. They could all be called that. But Sylvia's voice is almost worth the uptick in dread. It's soothing to me, even though she talks only of the invisible horseman galloping towards us. There are recognizable patterns of ascent and decline, but our industrial civilization is so vast, it has such reach. I look out the window. Something in the distance, limping toward the trees.
That's author Jenny Offill reading an excerpt from her novel, Weather. As the title suggests, it's a book about climate change. But in a world of post-apocalyptic novels, Jenny may have invented a new genre, the pre-apocalyptic novel. What makes her writing style so fascinating is that she volleys back and forth between fiction and nonfiction in a way that replicates how our minds work. And maybe that's the reason why her protagonist has the job she has.
It's about a librarian named Lizzie who becomes a bit of a climate change doomer. Although, as the novel moves on, I think she comes out of that dark hole a little bit and moves towards something else. But it's about the trajectory of sort of first being concerned with your family and friends and those around you, and then slowly beginning to think about wider circles of concern.
So I'm curious about when you first became interested in the climate crisis. Was there something you read or heard that really ignited your interest?
It was a bit of a slow burn for me. I have a very good friend, Lydia Millett, who's also a novelist and has been working for an environmental organization, the Center for Biodiversity, for many decades now. And over the years, as we talked about everything else, she would talk to me about this. And I think at a certain point, I started wondering why I was intellectually interested but didn't feel anything. And then I began to read myself about it and try to learn so that I could understand the science. And then there was just a moment, I think a lot of people talk about this moment, when I realized how much worse it was than I had imagined. I think the last time I checked in on climate change, it was supposed to be something that would be terrible for our great-great-grandchildren. And the part where that timetable has moved up significantly was something that spurred me to write this novel. I especially wanted to write about what it is to go from kind of what I think of as like a twilight knowing about something to looking at it more steadily.
Yeah. Was there a central question that was on your mind while you were writing Weather?
If there was a question, it might have been, how is it possible to worry about the whole world? As someone that ends up often being pretty entangled with the people around me, not just my family and friends, but also many wonderful students and neighbors, I sometimes feel like that's enough to fill your days. And when you start thinking about everything else, as I think many of us already have been doing, and many of us maybe have come to in the last 4 years, to sort of feel like they need to do different things and more things as citizens, I wanted to write about that process in some way that was not about a light shining down on you kind of epiphany, but more of a slower thing. Also, with climate stuff, there's this very interesting entanglement that begins where you start to notice non-human creatures in a different way, I think, as you become more aware of how things are interconnected. And that was interesting to write about as well.
Yeah. When you were writing Weather, you imagined it as a survival manual for your daughter. Do you still think of it this way?
Well, for a long time, I kept putting an actual survival manual in it. I had this idea that there was going to be like a rip-out survival manual. And it was something that I worked on this book for about 6.5 or 7 years. And it was one of those things I just wrestled with because I could never get it right formally. It never quite worked. And at a certain point, I realized it was because I no longer believed that that's what I wanted the book to be. I ended up incorporating, which was a lot of fun, a lot of those survival facts into the novel. But actually, what I was more interested by the end in was emotional prepping or spiritual prepping.
If you don't mind my asking, has your daughter read Weather?
Yeah, she has, actually. Yeah.
What did she think of it?
She said she liked it. I think that she was surprised in some ways because I've been talking about this for years. I think she was surprised that it wasn't a more direct take on climate. But I really wanted to write about what it's like to live with that as a kind of ambient dread, kind of mm-hmm. in the background. And so I think there's been a lot of great nonfiction work, and there's been a lot of novels often imagining, like, what will happen if we don't do anything or what road are we on. But I kind of wanted to write a pre-apocalyptic where it was about those moments of flickering in and out of thinking about it.
I wanted to ask you about this because, yeah, it seems like you've invented this new genre with Weather. You've created this pre-apocalyptic novel genre in a world chock full of post-apocalyptic novels. So that was an intentional move on your part, right?
It was. I just thought that at least often I'm trying when I write a novel to come closer to the way that I think or sort of the associations that I find I'm having with a particular idea I'm engaging with. And one of the things I noticed about it was how I could just drop in and out of it. And when I blocked it out, I really blocked it out. Mm. And that became less possible the farther in I was. And I sort of came up to what I think a bit of a roadblock at a certain point because I felt like, okay, I know this now. I can't unknow how dire the situation is. But what am I going to do? And is it about individual action? Because I think that to some extent we've sort of been sold a bill of goods about here's 32 tips to green your house and here's this and if you buy the right light bulbs. And it's not really necessarily been about how, you know, there's 100 corporations that are emitting the greatest amount of this. And so I thought to myself, I'm not a particularly good person who has managed to be pure in this area. I mean, I felt like there needed to be some way to engage that didn't involve having to first make your whole life perfectly pure. And so that's what I kind of came up with. It was a bit of a joke at first, but I was thinking, you know, activism for hypocrites. That's what I want to do.
Yeah, yeah. Your writing style is so unique because you include all of these facts, these quotations, and interesting bits of information. It seemed like you did a little bit of that in your debut novel, mm-hmm. The Last Things, and then you kind of did more in Department of Speculation, but it seems like there's even more in Weather. Why did you start doing this?
I partly did it because I was trying to find a way to write when the writing wasn't going well. Mm. And I'm always someone that has really loved to kind of read across disciplines. I mean, I went to a pretty mediocre public high school, and it wasn't until I went to college at University of North Carolina that I got that course catalog and saw, wow, you know, anthropology, comparative religion, all these different things that were very exciting to me to sort of delve into all these different areas. And in a way, that's never quite left me. So when I'm working on a book, often over a span of many years, the part that is fun to me is the part where I'm reading in a funny way away from the subject. Mm-hmm. Like first with climate stuff, I read the science, of course. But then as I moved out to psychology of various kinds of denial or to sociology, somehow the farther I go, the more my brain sort of lights up about it. Maybe because it feels like things I haven't come across before.
Mm-hmm. A great example of this might be the Native American shoe swap passage in Weather. Why did you want to include this passage?
I guess in the same way that I was noticing ways that I balked when I was first reading environmental things, sometimes it was that I felt like right as we were getting into the interesting part of something, then I would feel kind of a wall of mm-hmm. numbers or statistics come my way. Mm-hmm. I also felt like that since I began writing this book, I think there has been a lot more understanding, I hope, in the environmental movement about letting Indigenous people talk for themselves about their own traditions and how their land management might differ from the way our sort of extractive economy. But at the time, I felt like when I was going places, I was constantly listening to white people like myself appropriate and kind of talk about these Native American ideas. And it was very unclear whether or not it was what a person would say from that actual uh-huh. background, or whether it was that sort of idea of like, oh, the magical world of the Native Americans. And what I found when I've been going to climate conferences since then is often when people speak for themselves, the story that comes out is much more layered and complicated. And that's what I was trying to get at, that Lizzie is both interested in hearing these stories and also at this point in the book, quite early on, quite skeptical about what it means to join in with this movement.
Yeah. How would you describe your writing style, which strikes me as very off-Illian or off-Illian-esque, if you prefer?
Oh, thank you. That's your dream, right? That one day someone will put an esque at the name of your,
Absolutely.
At the end of my quite difficult to say last name. It might be mispronounced as awful-esque, which sounds like it wouldn't be great.
Yeah, and isn't accurate at all.
Thank you. I think my style is, it often gets called fragmentary, and I do work in small segments and then link them together. I work sort of at the sentence and paragraph level, and then I let them stay for a while, and it's about halfway or three quarters of the way through a book that I figure out how they go together as a story. But sometimes the word fragmentary feels a little sharper edged than what I'm doing, because my novels may not be plotted in the traditional way, but I'm very, very interested in emotion and in momentum of emotion. So they're not fragmentary in the sense that they have sort of no interest in why we like a narrative. I mean, humans love stories and have since we sat around fires. We still like that. It's like story is as important as melody is in music. So when I do something different with it, I try to bring in other things, whether it's these facts that you were talking about or whether it's extra attention to sort of the language and what layers might be in the language.
Can you talk a bit about your creative process, what it was like while you were writing Weather? Especially I'm curious about how you decided which quotes and sentences from other sources you were going to incorporate.
What I realized for me that it was taking things that I found in nonfiction sources, typing them out exactly as they are with their sources, and just keeping a file of them. And that was sometimes the way that I tricked myself into writing. And so I often have people wonder, because my novels are quite short, oh, did you have a very, very long novel that you cut down? But no, but I did have, you know, 300 pages of notes about all these different things. And sometimes I go to a library and I wander around, and the only rule is no fiction or poetry sections. And I pick out books and I sort of flip through them. I call it library roulette in my mind.
Oh, nice.
And then I wait to see what jumps out at me. Often they're very densely written academic works. So there's a way in which it feels sort of like they're a little covered over with the jargon and the language that is used in a specific discipline. And then I see what jumps out at me, and then I put it aside in this file, and I don't yet know how I'm going to use it. And then when I'm writing the narrative part of a novel, which often has more to do with the way I'm thinking about character and the way I'm thinking about emotion, I sort of see what floats in.
Yeah. There's a lot of humor in Weather. Did you include so much humor in order to compensate for a lot of the content that might strike the reader as depressing, or was there another reason?
I did. I mean, I think that anytime you kind of have one tone in a novel, that it can become tiresome or kind of claustrophobic. I mean, this is also a novel that's first person, and so I do feel like when there's humor in a book, it gives you another way in to the character that is not just the most serious moments of their life. Also, I'm just a real sucker for anything that's sad and funny at the same time. I don't feel like enough books are in that category, but I know the first time I ever read, you know, Jesus' Son by Dennis Johnson, that was what slayed me about it, was that it was so dark. And then some of the parts that were funny were just really hilarious to me. So I think that I'm always hoping to do that.
At the end of your book, just before the acknowledgments, there's the name of a website, obligatorynoteofhope.com. And on this website, you ask the question, how can we imagine and create a future we want to live in? Do you have any ideas about what the answer to this question is?
The reason I wanted to make the website, the information on the website, separate from the book is there's a little joke in the book about the obligatory note of hope, and it's Sylvia, who's been doing this environmental work for so long. At one point, Lizzie calls her, and she says, oh, I can't talk to you right now. I'm writing an article, and I have to put on the obligatory note of hope. Mm-hmm. And it is something that if you start to read environmental articles, you notice, because it's quite strange. It's like these incredibly dark facts, incredibly dark information. And then at the end, they'll just, it's like an upswell of music. It'll be like, but if everything comes together all at the right time and we all do this. And you feel sort of like, I don't know. Maybe it's all going to be okay. And so I did come across things that made me feel hopeful while I was working on this novel. And I wanted to put them somewhere, but I didn't want it to feel like a false uplift. And I just feel like this part where we all start, I mean, obviously I'm a big lover of cross-disciplinary things anyway, but the part where I think we kind of come out of our silos of dread and start talking to each other and figuring out what it is that each of us not just thinks they should do, but can stand to do. Because, you know, you have to do something that you find meaningful. And that's going to be really different for different people.
Jenny Offill, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Jenny Offill is the author of Weather. Find out more about Jenny at wpr.org/beta.
My wife always kind of says, when I hear this record, I hear the affection for each other, the way we sing and play together. We really love each other, too. It's a good hang.
Eric Johnson of the folk supergroup Bonnie Light Horseman on how he and his bandmates breathe new life into old folk songs. That's coming up next. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. The folk trio Bonnie Light Horseman has a distinct musical goal. The group works to transform traditional folk music into contemporary songs. Comprised of Tony Winner and Hadestown creator Aeneas Mitchell, producer Josh Kaufman, and Fruit Bat's frontman, Eric Johnson. Eric joins us now to discuss the band's self-titled debut.
We've got Aeneas Mitchell in the band and Josh Kaufman. Aeneas, she's barely known for her solo work for years, incredible songwriter, and then has had kind of an explosively crazy last couple of years in that she has this song cycle, Hadestown, that turned into a Broadway phenomenon, which is amazing.
Yeah.
And then Josh Kaufman is one of the greatest secret weapons in all of modern music.
Wow.
He's a just sort of a magical presence. He's a producer and a songwriter and this sort of very low-key, behind-the-scenes guy. It's been very fun being in a band with him where he gets to be kind of the guy.
Mm. So how did you meet Aeneas and Josh?
Aeneas, I met the stupidest way possible, which was on the internet. she shouted me out on Twitter.
Oh, really?
Which is, you know, sometimes good things happen on Twitter, and that was one of them. She was kind of a new to Fruit Bat's listener and did the thing, was like, I love this band, and tagged me. And I had, funnily enough, just kind of started digging her music, too.
Oh, cool.
So we sort of had discovered each other. And then Josh, I've known for years. We've worked on lots of sort of small, short-term musical projects with him, but nothing huge. And I always knew I wanted to do something big with him, and then he was working on this thing with Aeneas, and it all kind of came together. In the magpie's nest. In the magpie's nest. In the magpie's nest.
where did the idea to reimagine old, possibly forgotten folk songs come from?
It started with those two. Anais, she's from Vermont. She grew up with folk music in her house. Josh and I are way more kids of rock and roll and top 40 radio.
Yeah.
So I always say, like, he and I are kind of coming from the side door of the Grateful Dead and the Byrds and Bob Dylan and things like that. So I've always been interested in folk rock and then working my way backwards.
Right. Where does the group's name Bonnie Light Horseman, where does that come from?
That is, well, that's one of the songs. We always joke the name of this band and the name of the song and the name of the album is all the same thing.
Yes, the title track.
Yeah, I mean, the song is old and it comes from the Napoleonic Wars.
Oh, Napoleon Bonaparte, you're the cause of my woe, since my Bonnie Light Horseman.
I mean, it's just a song of incredible sadness. It's this completely hopeless story of a man who's gone to war and his love kind of singing of it and kind of singing about being a dove flying across the sea to find him. And you don't really get the end of the story, but you know it's not good.
And if I was some small bird, and if I had wings to fly, I would fly over the ocean.
But it was just a collection of words that feel very elemental and kind of simple. And we had a few band names. We were trying to come up with band names, and we had that song already. And somehow, that just became the name of the band. I'm not exactly sure how we landed on it, but it needed to be.
Your version manages to convey this really contemporary sense of emotional immediacy. How did the three of you accomplish this?
I think that's something that has really resonated with people with that song and the whole album. Anais has said time and time again, which I always like to quote her, that this is not a research project. So there's sort of two ways you could approach this type of music. You could go research project, honoring the root of it. You could go dramatically in the opposite direction and be like, we're going to put this under 808 techno beats and there's going to be synthesizers and just be like very futuristic with it or sort of take it in the most unexpected direction possible. And we sort of did neither of those. It was a middle path.
Yeah.
And I think that it's shocking when you sort of start digging through these songs how the human experience and human condition has just remained the same since year zero. And yeah, I think that's just people are sort of feeling that. So we didn't set out to do it. We just, the songs are there.
Yeah, so what did you set out to do? Because there's clearly, you know, there's a difference between the original version and your version. So, I mean, with this song in particular, the title track and the name of the band, Bonnie Light Horseman, what were you trying to do? Did you have a goal in mind? Like, you know what I'm trying to ask?
I think we had a goal, I think, of just like this emotional impact, you know? And then these songs are these durable pieces of work, you know? And then, like with any song, though, like if you wrote a song in the studio, if it's like an original song or something like that, you go in and then this chord becomes this chord and this word gets changed or something like that. And things just sort of slowly melt into what they need to be. I think that there was that. There was the fact that we recorded a lot of this in Berlin while without a lot of time and with being very jet lagged. So I think there is a little bit of like a dream sort of fugue state quality to some of these that I think was really effective. Could have been bad, but wasn't.
Yeah.
And I think we all really love each other too. My wife always kind of says, wow, it's just, when I hear this record, I hear the affection for each other, like the way we sing and play together. And
yeah.
I think that was a very real thing, too.
how do you discover these old folk songs, and how do you decide which ones you want to reimagine?
They were kind of all over the place. There was a few things that Aeneas had been enamored of, but there was not a mandate for how this was going to work either. Josh has this excellent book that, now I'm trying to remember the name of it. It has something, a very simple name, like Folk Songs of the British Isles or something. It's a gigantic sort of more textbooky type book has all these old songs. Mm. So we sort of had this Bible. That was a little bit of the Bible. They had picked a few, which I don't even know how they came up with. And when I came to New York to work with them, I had a couple things that I was interested in. Jane was one that I brought into the fold. Deep in Love was a song that was just a melody that I had that was a Fruit Bats demo that didn't pan out. And then Josh very excitedly was like, I have the lyrics for that. It was in that book.
Ooh, yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. The second track on the album is Deep in Love, and it sounds like it would be at home on a Fruit Bats record, which is your main recording project. And can you tell us a bit more about the source material of the song and how far you strayed from the original version?
I couldn't tell you that I've ever heard the original version of that song. I don't know what it sounds like. Huh. We just had the lyrics. I had that chorus, which was Don't You Break My Heart. And then I had this these verses that were just sort of do-do-do, la-la-la, kind of wordless melody. And Josh, you know, this is like, sounds made up, but completely true. He just opened to that page and said, sing those lyrics over that melody. And it fit completely perfectly. We cut several verses, too, which you often do with these. A lot of these songs are truly epic. So we just sort of went with the verses that spoke to us. But every single one of these songs on the record kind of has a different story like that.
The Roving is up next on the record, featuring Aeneas on vocals. How did you guys reconfigure this song?
So that song and Deep in Love came up around the same time, which was we had done this Berlin session, which was this kind of whirlwind. And then we had a couple of days to sort of finish things up in Woodstock, New York. And Deep in Love was sort of an 11th hour entrant, as was The Roving. And The Roving is one of those I had mentioned, like some of these songs are a couple of different songs pasted together. That was one. Mm. And Aeneas had put that together, and that's based on a song called Loving Hannah.
I could see her mind was a-changing.
I knew her love was changing
by the roving of her eye.
By the roving of her eye.
By the roving of her eye.
The roving. The roving of her eye.
We learned it sort of the day we recorded it. Mm. Yeah, and then she changed the name Hannah to Annie, which is the name of my wife and also the name of Josh's wife.
Interesting.
As a little nod.
Yeah. Oh, very nice. An homage, so to speak. Yeah.
Yeah.
The material on your album ranges from pretty faithful to the original to extreme Frankensteinian assembly of bits and pieces. How do the three of you decide how much tinkering to do with each song?
Something like Jane Jane, that's a Frankenstein of Jane Jane, and also a Christmas song called Children Go Where I Send Thee.
Children go where I send thee.
Oh, Lordy,
how will I send thee? Oh, I'm gonna send thee one by one.
But that, somebody else actually had mashed those up already, which is this singer-songwriter named Tia Blake, who was a 1970s sort of obscure American folk singer. And we really just... There's a lot of versions of that, but
yeah.
I was just madly in love with that version of hers.
Hey, hey, my Lord and Lord, I'm gonna buy...
And your version of Jane Jane also strikes me as pretty faithful to the Peter, Paul, and Mary version from the mid-1960s.
It definitely is, and I didn't even know that version until after we had started. We sort of referenced that one, too, and I was like, oh, because I think probably the Tia Blake version... might be based on that one too. So, but again, this is just the story of folk music.
Yeah, exactly.
Right here.
Rough, 3-3 for the Hebrew children.
2 for Paul and Silas. 1 for the itty bitty baby. Born in Bethlehem.
Hey.
What does it say about all of these old songs that they're able to maintain their power and impact when you're adding new lyrics and new structures to them?
I think Aeneas always refers to the, or, and this was, she's quoting someone else, but I can't remember who, which is, you can't break these songs. These are, and we've used the word durability a lot, or durable.
That's
with
a
these.
Great word, yeah.
I think it's kind of unbreakable, and it's meant to evolve.
Mm-hmm.
It is funny when there's folk music dogma, because I'm like, well, how do you be dogmatic about something that's so so ever-evolving and so old?
Yeah. The last song on the album is called 10,000 Miles, and it's been recorded in many forms by many artists. The lyrics and the story are pretty universal, and they kind of even remind me of a song like Boots of Spanish Leather by Bob Dylan. Do you think Bobby Z had 10,000 miles in mind when he wrote Boots of Spanish Leather?
That's a good question. I mean, Bobby Z, I think we would have been buds with him back
in
64.
Yeah, I think so too. Really good buds. Really good buds.
But I'd like to think, at least.
Well, I think you're right.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was, you know, again, we're all kind of drinking from the same well a little bit, too. And then, of course, he wasn't after a few years, which I also am like, I think we're going to do our own plug-in at Newport thing, I'm sure, at some point, and piss some people off. But I think, like, he was certainly a very important artist for me, and it's because he was doing exactly what I'm talking about, which is he had a lot of respect for history, and then he had a lot of disrespect for history in a good way, I think, you know, sort of the right kind of disrespect.
Oh, I'm sailing away, my own true love.
Fare thee well, my own true love.
Yeah. So is Bonnie Light Horseman a one-time recording project, or are there more reimaginings in your future?
No, there's reimaginings in the future. We actually Excellent. Already have writing/brainstorming sessions starting to brew. And we really love each other, too. It's a good hang.
In the seas they will burn,
Eric Johnson is a member of the band Bonnie Light Horseman. Find out more at WPR.org/beta.
We wanted to keep this about canine actors, but of course I love all these classic animated films as well. They're really great dog roles.
Wendy Mitchell joins us to talk about her book, Citizen Canine, Dogs in the Movies. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta. From Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Quick, think of your favorite dog from a movie. Is it Lassie? Is it Old Yeller? Or is it the lovable St. Bernard Beethoven? Chances are the dog you're thinking about is featured in Wendy Mitchell's book, Citizen Canine. Dogs in the Movies. The book features 60 of the bravest, cutest, goodest dogs to ever appear in film. We spoke with Wendy about some of the most outstanding performances by a canine in motion pictures.
I am a lover of dogs and a lover of movies, and I love dog movies. And I just was surprised nobody had ever done it. I mean, one thing that really inspired me is I usually write about more sort of serious topics in the film industry, about how films are financed and produced. And I was having some meetings in LA and happened to meet a dog that was descended from the original pal who had played Lassie.
Oh, cool.
And that just really got me thinking about Hollywood history and dogs and why we need to celebrate these canine actors as well as the human actors.
Interesting. So walk us, pun pretty much unavoidable, walk us through how you compiled this book. You profile 60 dogs. What qualities were you looking for?
I wanted to show a real mix of breeds, of different kinds of films. You know, they're not just kids' films in the book. We have Cujo, for example,
yes.
which you should not show to a kid.
No, definitely not.
So, yeah, I wanted to look at a range of history. The book covers 100 years. There's some really great films in the book. There are, to be fair, some maybe some dogs of films, we could say. Films that maybe are not great but have a great dog in them. You know, one example might be Little Nicky, the Adam Sandler movie. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not a huge fan of this film, but there's a bulldog in it called Mr. Beefy, who is just wonderful.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, even though I don't love the film, I love the dog.
Yeah.
So we could include that as well.
Yeah, and the voice of that dog is done by Robert Schmeigel, right?
I believe. Of course,
yes,
yeah.
Who also was famous for Triumph the Insult comic dog, yeah.
Yes, he's done two good dog voices there.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So here at Beta, we like to be as playful and provocative as possible, so we thought it would be kind of fun to have our own version of the Oscars honoring the most outstanding performances by dogs in movies. Let's call
it... Wow, there are so many.
Yeah, let's...
Collars.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So
great.
The Collars, there you go. So, yeah, the Citizen Canine Academy Awards, the Collars, that's great.
I'm honored. I'm ready.
I'm honored that you're honored. So here we go. Our first award is for Outstanding Performance by a Dog in a Comedy. Which dog takes home the coveted collar?
I'm going to go with Beethoven. St. Bernard, bumbling on screen, you know, just a funny dog. And I love this sort of interplay with the grumpy dad, who is played by Charles Grodin, of course.
Beethoven, come on, down.
Giorgio, is there some problem?
No, just...
Did I miss anything?
No, Giorgio has just gone over all the papers, and he's about to sign.
Oh, you get out of here, you mutt.
I pitched in college.
One thing I learned in researching is there's usually several dogs,
mm-hmm.
And I think in Beethoven... There was one main dog who I think name was Chris that played most of the role. But then, you know, they might have other St. Bernards doing like a stand-in here, or maybe one is really good at jumping, or one is really good at looking cute laying down. But the main one was called Chris. And I actually spoke to an animal trainer called Teresa Ann Miller, whose dad, Carl Lewis Miller, was... really famous dog trainer, and he worked with Chris, and she remembered Chris as just being sort of really chilled out dog. So I think it is doing some good acting to be this sort of boisterous St. Bernard that's ruining their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Our next caller category is Outstanding Performance by a Dog in a Heartbreakingly Sad Film. What does it say in your envelope?
Are there ties allowed?
Yes,
in the Fido?
Okay, we can have co-winners.
Amazingly, it looks like we have a tie this year, and I think it's going to be a tie between Old Yeller and Marley and Me.
Mm.
I mean, I have to say I cried a lot in the researching of this book.
Mm.
I just find its dog film so moving. I think you really, if you see a dog, you know, ill or... slipping away on screen, you think of somebody you've lost or a dog you've lost, and it can be really emotional. So I think, you know, Old Yeller, so many kids, you know, this is one of the pivotal movies of childhood that, you know, might scar you for life.
Mama, listen. Old Yeller just saved your life, and Elizabeth too, and he saved mine and Alice's. We don't know for certain. I'll pin him up where he can't get out, and then we'll wait. We can't just shoot him like he was nothing. Don't you understand?
I won't say anymore. But so that's a really sad movie for me. And I think Marley and Me, oh my goodness, when Owen Wilson is having to say goodbye to Marley, gosh, how can you watch that with a dry eye? And, you know, again, there were several dogs who played Marley, and that was sort of the one of the older dogs that was playing in the final scenes. And, oh, you know, it's so just heart-wrenching to see when people have to say goodbye to their dogs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Our final category in this year's Coveted Collar Awards is outstanding performance by a dog in a rom-com co-starring Jack Nicholson and Helen Hunt. And the winner is?
Oh, well, gosh. I mean, the votes might be closed. this one, of course, is As Good As It Gets, and I love this dog. The dog's name is Verdell. It's a Brussels Griffon, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. And, you know, we see sort of certain themes come up in a lot of dog films, and I think this is really showing the angle that, you know, even like the hardest heart, the grumpiest old man can be turned around, can open his heart because of a dog. And, you know, As Good As It Gets, yeah, Jack opens his heart to Verdell, and then he can open his heart to an actual human companion as well.
You wanna know why the dog prefers me? It's not affection. It's a trick. I keep bacon in my pocket. See?
Oh my gosh.
The dog who played most of the role was called Jill, mm-hmm. actually. So Jack and Jill were together.
And, yes.
You know, Jill really loved working with Jack, but she would get confused because obviously there's scenes when he has to be sort of gruff towards her. So here was her buddy Jack, who was nice to her all day, you know, during breaks, on the set, they're best of pals. And then when the cameras are rolling, he has to be a little mean to her. But I think they sort of made up, and she sort of understood in the end that Jack really was her buddy.
That concludes this edition of the Citizen Canine Academy Awards. Nice and short. It didn't go on and on and on like some award ceremonies. I'm not going to name any names, but we did... Yes, exactly. Indeed. We did crowdsource our fans for their favorite canine scene stealer, and a few of our alphas, that's what we call beta fans, alphas, a few of our alphas mentioned Beethoven from the 1992 film Beethoven, and as we just found out a few minutes ago, that won the Caller Award for Outstanding Performance by a Dog in a Comedy. And Beethoven, I believe, was played by Chris, right? And also a mechanical dog was involved. Yeah. Some more of our alphas cited dogs from animated movies like Up and Toy Story. Did you ever consider including animated dogs in your book?
I did, because there's so many great animated dog films, and these characters, you know, can be really amazing and touching and well-written and really are a big part of movie lives. But ultimately, I wanted this particular book to be about the canine actors. Mm. So how do they work with them? How do they work with them on set? How do they train them? And it didn't seem quite fair to put, you know, Lady and the Tramp, the animated classic, you know, next to a real dog who had to just sit in a handbag or something. So, yeah, ultimately, I decided with the publisher we wanted to keep this about canine actors. But, of course, I love all these classic animated films as well. They're really great dog roles in those.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Very well said. I want to ask you about Samuel Fuller's 1982 film White Dog. This was one of the more intriguing entries in your book, I thought. First of all, can you tell us a bit about what that film is about?
Sure. I mean, that's one thing. It was really important to me to show maybe a few left field choices. It's not just a bunch of Disney films in the book.
Yeah.
So Sam Fuller, great director, wanted to look at racism. And so this film is about a dog that's discovered that wants to attack black people. It's been trained to attack any black person it sees, you know, trained by a white supremacist somewhere. And this, you know, lovely young actress meets the dog and loves the dog, but then notices how he interacts. And then they try to sort of reprogram it.
That ain't no attack dog you got. That's a white dog.
Of course he's a white dog.
I don't mean his color. He's going to attack and kill black people.
That's crazy. I don't believe that.
You see the scar, lady? Well, I got that when I was 14 years old. A white dog did it.
So this film works on many, many levels, I think. I mean, just a straight story, but also, you know, is this dog standing in for a human white supremacist? So it's a fascinating story. And also have some really outstanding films like White Dog, like Sounder, to show that, you know, serious directors and serious films can make the most of dogs as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. We've talked about dogs in films, but we haven't broached films about dogs. The best known is likely Christopher Guest's 2000 mockumentary, Best in Show. Can you tell us about the canine stars of this film?
Oh, gosh. I mean, this, what a film for dog lovers or anybody who's ever watched The Westminster Dog Show or Crufts, which is the big one here in England. The dogs are so adorable, and you see the human beings around them being quite ridiculous and silly. So the dogs come out looking amazing. The humans are a bit neurotic.
You want your busy bee? You get your busy bee.
You get the busy bee. I need to trim her whiskers. It's in the crate.
Where is it?
It's in the crate.
Why didn't you have it out to begin with? Where is the crate? It's not in here. It's not in here.
It should be in the crate.
It's not in the crate. I just told you that.
God, Hamilton, if she doesn't get her door, she's going to flip out.
Yeah. It's not in here. You left it at the hotel. You go back and you get her busy bee. Go to the hotel and get busy bee.
You know, it's it's a whole sort of subculture. I think Christopher Guest is a genius in whatever he does.
Yeah.
And there's just a really wonderful song in this film, too, called God Loves a Terrier.
When he made the Norwich merrier with its cute little derrier. Yes, God loves a terrier.
It also feels like, as much as Christopher Guest might be making fun a little bit of the dog show world, there's a love, too, for these people and how much they love and care about their dogs. And for the dogs themselves that are just so impeccably groomed. Fantastic film. Really
right.
Funny.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever consider expanding your concept to include dogs on TV, or is that maybe your next book?
There's so many great dogs on TV. You know, could be another book. You know, for instance, the movie My Dog Skip, which is one of my favorite dog movies. Just I found it so emotional. The part of Skip is played by two Jack Russell Terriers named Enzo and Moose, and they are father and son. And Moose from My Dog Skip, who plays the elder Skip, people would recognize as Eddie from TV's Frasier.
Yes.
So there is some crossover in what dogs, you know, may act for the small screen and the big screen. But yeah, there's obviously, and you know, obviously Lassie started out in cinema, but then moved very successfully over to TV. Yeah, there's a lot of overlap, and obviously I love dogs on TV as well.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. You said that you love movies and adore dogs. So if you had to go through life without one of those, which would you choose?
Oh, my goodness. What a tough question. Oh, gosh. Sophie's Choice. I can't do
it. Yes, exactly.
right now I don't have a dog of my own because my day job means I'm going to film festivals several times a month. So I'm, you know, out of town, out of the country a lot. And I just don't think it would be fair to have a dog. So I guess if I had to choose one or the other, I might go for the films because I could then watch the dogs on screen.
Mm-hmm.
Is that cheating?
No, that's not cheating at all. Yeah. It was a tough question. Okay. I asked the tough questions. So that you answered
the
that
hard hitting.
The hard hitting. We're questions. Very hard hitting here at Beta. But I was going to ask you, if you had a dog, but you just told me you didn't. So here's a hypothetical question. If you did have a dog, what do you think your dog's favorite film would be?
No, I think, you know, if I had a dog, I think one film that I would hope my dog would love would be something like Homeward Bound, where it's really, you see less people on screen and it's about the animals. It's this dog and a cat going across the country. So I like to think, if you put that on for your dog, they might really respond to it because there's not all these silly people and their dialogue getting in the way. It's, you know, watching these animals triumph and be the real stars and the main event.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great film. Yeah. Wendy Mitchell, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Wendy Mitchell is the author of Citizen Canine, Dogs in the Movies. Let us know which one of your favorite doggies deserves a caller award by sending a note to beta@wpr.org. Find out more about Wendy at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Jenny Offill, Eric Johnson, and Wendy Mitchell. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to producer Brad Colbert.
What do you want more than anything in the world? You want the big blue ribbon? Uh-huh, that's what you want. You want red? No, you don't want red. You want yellow? No, you don't want yellow. You want to go home with the blue.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I was born with two left feet, and they had a nickname for me. They used to call me Loopy.
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
I mean, he still pushes all my buttons, and I'm the one having to push him away.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
And he's saying I'm ready. That's when he, you know he's ready for a show.